here we are again. Floating Zendo started coming here after going to a number of different places. We went to Pema Osling, Tibetan place in the mountains up here, with an enormous golden Buddha. We went to a little Catholic nunnery down by the ocean in Carmel that gave us not only the sound of the sea, but we could cross the highway and be right there and in the ocean and walk along beside the ocean. We went to Camp Double Bear, which was a series of what they call the round ones, yurts. There are three or four yurts, and you slept in the yurts, and you practiced in the yurts in a circle in the woods. So we heard coyotes, and it was probably the roughest place that we went to, the least comfortable. And then we started coming here after really a number of years. I have no idea how many years anymore. But there was a reaching out and a responding. I think Trikoji asked us to come. And we thought, And since there was a long history, for some of us, we grew up with Trikoji from the very, very beginning. It seemed quite appropriate to come here and reconnect and resume and deepen our connection with this place. And so we've been doing that for the last few years, and it's been very, very nourishing, I think, for all of us just to be in this atmosphere. As I came this afternoon and just sat down on the deck and looked out into the forest and the trees and the sky, I remembered all over again why it was that we did this crazy thing and made this place. It seemed totally crazy, even to the ones of us who were doing it. Not to speak of those who were involved and thought it was a really, really crazy idea. It started from scratch. I still remember the scream of the grinder and grinding up the bushes that we cut as I looked through the open area between the trees and remembered how Doris and I used to chop up all these bushes in the freezing cold of the November afternoon as the dark was coming. We'd be feeding these bushes in there. And now it's just a place in which to be and find some balance and some clarity, not only on the cushion, but as we participate in the life of the nature around us, the Buddha life. When I was a girl in junior high school, I lost my very powerful connection with what my church called God. And it was a traumatic experience, I think, that many of us have had, where it's so certain up to a point. And then I think it's the development, the actual development of the brain, that allows a child to begin to think in a more rational way and a way that it's asking rather than just assuming and believing and accepting what everybody says. And it's a terrible situation in a way. It's liberating. It's essential for a human being. But it's a tragic loss at the same time. People have different ways, have had different ways of being with this. Mine was to start writing the why all over my school papers, up and down in my notebooks, putting it in pencil in my school books. Why? Why? And it seemed like everything was just saturated with this question, this mysterious question. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that it's really the wrong question. It's a totally human, original answer question that expects a logical answer when there isn't any. We're always hoping to find the reason why something is happening. You know, whether, you know, somebody gets cancer, they say, oh, well, it's how you were leading your life and you ate the wrong food and you had bad ideas and besides your great-grandfather was murdered or something weird like that. There are many, many stories made up on the why, trying to explain what it is that happens to us. Things are happening to us all the time, of course. And we can take too much responsibility. Often, as children, it's my fault that my parents divorced. That often happens. And it's very sad for children because, of course, it has nothing to do with them at all. It's a very natural way of trying to find our balance in the world to answer this question, why? Often we say it's karma. We were reading about karma on the way up here yesterday, and Jane found a place in the sutras where Buddha was saying, look, karma isn't about you're getting old or getting sick or being stupid or something like that. That isn't karma. It's much more deep and complicated than that, and it has to do with all the many, many things that come together to create this moment, this place, this time, this one, this being. And the responsibility we have as living, thinking beings of how we step forward moment by moment. But the real question I came to after I was reading Plato and Aristotle and Wittgenstein and Spinoza was that the question is what? What is this? We can't possibly answer the why. And the what takes us into places that we don't tend to go. Where does it take you? Where does it take me? What is this? The is. We are the is. We are the moment. We are the time and place. And it's not that we are massively controlling things as this, but that we are a part of an elaborate dance in which all things are moving and changing and living and dying, all of us together. The acorns and the banana slugs and the swallows, the laurels, the oaks. Usually we don't pay much attention, jumping in the car and driving along. It's hard to notice the what. But as we sit down in this way, we have a chance to experience this inconceivable mind of us, place of us, home of us. So in a way, our zazen is coming home, returning to where we've always been, returning and coming to terms again, beginning again, finding our stories. The stories come and remind us of who we are and often surprise us by looking ridiculous. Did I think that? Is that really what I thought? Koban once said, whatever you think in zazen is a lie. So that's a horrifying thought in a way. But thinking itself is a kind of blunder of our mind activity, that it becomes it gets in the way, even though we can't do anything about it. We can't stop the flow of it coming from the Koban, Dogen call it the deep well, the spring that's always flowing. We sit with and whatever the story is, we can see it changing. We can't hold on to any of it. The what is so ephemeral. If we try to pin it down into a thing, even a very wonderful thing, it can't be held. And it's the not holding, the not grasping, opening up our thinking, not closing it down, not throwing it away, not trying to make it something else, but just letting it be what it is and be surprised. So our amusement and our fancy this week is to see how we manage to not stay the same, just to be with how everything's go as things go, and try not to hold a particular position, but to be as we are when we are in the moment. every teacher talks about being present. Over and over in Dogen's writing, it's all about being present. And so in Zazen, we have an opportunity to be present without a lot of distractions, except the ones that our mind cooks up for us. And then we have a chance to recognize those cooked up distractions and not be thrown by them. Oh, that's just whatever. Just one more whatever. And in the meantime, the what of us, the whole life of us, is living and being lived. It's such a fortunate position to find ourselves in, to be like this. It's very complicated to, one, come together in this way, to all of us find the same time, to all of us find the same practice, and the same place, and the same teachers. It's really quite amazing thinking of all the directions that have come to put us here now as we are. And what we are is carrying forth all of that as we live and sit and breathe here. Going back so far, we don't know how far back. When we chant the names of Buddha, the seven Buddhas before Shakyamuni Buddha only stand for an infinite number of beings practicing before us and bringing it here together with us today. I think of those who they must have been, what they must have been like, what kind of lives that people led. Neanderthals. I'm sure they were sitting. Of course. So as we sit, we're sitting. Part of our what is our ancestry. That's all of us. So I won't say much more. Leave room for questions. I know this is a tiring day, so are there questions or discussion?
Well, your what reminded me of, and maybe this is on somewhere on the mark, but maybe not, of something that was people did back a few years where they would ask a person, who are you? And they'd have an answer in their mind, in their thoughts. And then the question would be asked again, who are you?
Mm.
And again and again until you got deeper and deeper into that question of who and what you are.
Mm-hmm.
Just kept expanding. It was
yeah.
Going there with that white business.
Yes, it was one of the Esalen teachers, forgotten their names, those great psychologists who brought the New Age into existence with all kinds of confrontation kinds of practices. Yeah.
it also seems that sometimes your idea of what how things are can be cemented by other people feeling the same thing, you know, or caught up in the same conflict, and maybe from a different perspective. And that becomes more challenging than just to sit.
Well, a daily sitting practice is a big help with those things, because we're mostly among people and we're very affected by who we're with and where we are. But that little moment of separation, even if it's a 10 or 20 minute sit, brings you back to your own place. You take your seat, and if you have a daily practice, then that taking of the seat becomes familiar and easy to do. And it's easier to hold it throughout the day so that we're not so swayed. Doug?
So on the one hand, you take your seat so you're not swayed.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you don't have a fixed view.
That's right. Yeah.
Seems like a paradox.
It's endlessly paradoxical. It has to be that way. Yes.
We're waiting for the wand. Remove the paradox, right?
Oh, no.
I'm looking for it. Sorry.
That's really amazing how taking your seat, how many different views you can have just
yes.
That fast.
Yes. So right view is crucial.
Care to go into that?
Care to go into it?
Right view.
Right view, yes. Well, I'm not going to go really into it, but no. But having Buddha's teaching always in mind of selflessness in the world of self, of seeing the paradox and being able to live it without being discombobulated by it, so that the authority that you have, the authority, you know, is what comes this way and goes this way and this way. So that you need to have stability in order to be a part of the incredible dance.
When the base of stability is so huge.
Yes, there's nothing underfoot. Nothing to hold on to. That's what makes it easy.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah. Open the hand of thought, Uchiyama Roshi said. Bree?
This is a less esoteric question. I'm not sure I've just taken off, but I in the last round that we were sitting this morning, this pain started down into my shoulder and went streaking all the way down my arm in a way that I just was like, you know, I felt like I had to move it. I haven't had that experience before in sitting, and I don't know if it's because I've been wearing a mala for some time now, and if that's somehow affecting the balance, but just would love some instruction on what to do with that.
Often that's about the neck and how you hold the head, because the head is so heavy. And it's asking a lot to keep the head upright this way. And the only way we can do it is to keep it properly balanced. And so if we're, is it forward or back that it hurts the shoulder so much? In both ways, I think. If it's too far forward, which is how we tend to hold our head anyway, because we're all readers, or most of us have spent our life with books and computers and all of those things. And yeah, yoga teachers bump into this all the time, because most students are just over like this. And it's very hard to keep it. But sometimes you can keep it back too far, and that can be a strain too. So it's you kind of have to experiment. And often a pain like that will be telling you something about where your stresses lie. So if it's the left arm, is it? Yeah. It's all affected. It's all connected. So there's, you know, it may be starting in your ankle. But the whole body is involved with it. Ritu, you know a lot about the body.
Yeah.
A neck thing. Yeah. Samia?
Well, maybe I should start confessing all the cheating I've been doing while I'm sitting. But I noticed, and I would welcome any help, that like the falling asleep of the leg, what I try to do that has helped is engage both legs. It's kind of like you're doing some kind of exercise, and this is what I'm calling cheating, but maybe it's not cheating. Or holding the belly in or engaging the whole body. Like when you have an injury, let's say your knee, they try to strengthen around the muscles around it.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like when you start like engaging the body and being aware of it or around the area, all of a sudden after a little while, it just seems to release. And I don't know if that's just saying that I wasn't present from the beginning of this sit, because it's easy to sit the first 15-20 minutes, not much happens, and then comes the I gotta do this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling it cheating, but maybe it's not.
Well, it's
all the others that I've been seeing for a long time, I'd like to hear their cheating stories.
Oh, yes. Well, especially the first and second day or so, we try everything, convinced that if we can just figure it out, we'll make it okay. And the only way to make it okay is just to give it up, to give in, and let it be the way it is. It's hard. It's hard to do that because we want to control it. We want to think that we can control it. We can work with it. And we should work with it. We should work with that neck and find things that can help, including massage. It helps to massage your own shoulder and neck and relieve that stress. You can find those tight muscles.
You know, when I was studying in Canada, when I didn't have it as severe as what happened today, but not a lesser form of it, but still when I would sit for long periods, the cramp would start. The teacher hit me with the stick. And they released it.
Yes.
And so then I would like go down to the change room. If I didn't have a dokus on, I'd just be like whacking myself. No, because it worked.
Yes, I know it does.
And it was very effective for my
yes.
teachers as well when this opened.
Yes. Yes.
Well, so, clue, huh?
That's
there's it's a mental clench. Right?
Yes.
You can observe to see if there's a certain category of thought that precedes your noticing that involvement there. I'll also note right now that your right shoulder is higher than your left.
Mhm. I'm aware of that too.
Yeah. And perhaps rather than working with your shoulders, just fill the body with breath and let the sternum lift again. You know, just open the ladder of the chest, the ribs, and feel into the back of the neck and just see if there's tension and breathe into it and relax that. And I frequently wobble my head because I carry a lot of tension in the back of my neck. So I'll just give it a little wobble and loosen it up again. You can also adjust your mudra up and down a bit. You may be pushing slightly or holding slightly, and both of the things will cause problems in the shoulder and neck. So just check in and observe the type of thoughts that seem to be surrounding that.
It also helps to remember how it felt when you were hit. That actually you have that memory in you, so you can call it up and it will relax. Again, it's a mind thing. We had a stick for the first years with Coben. Long stick. And it was a mercy. I must say I miss it. I really miss it a lot. But Coben decided not to use it. He had a lot of experiences with people and found that there were some people who asked for the stick too much, you know, and took it as a kind of punishment. And some of them, there was sort of a self-blame, self-punishment thing that went into it that he thought was not a healthy way to go. That people should deal with their ideas and feelings without the help of that. In Japan, they beat the new students with those things until they bleed. They really, and that's the other side of it, of course, the sadistic side of the one who has the stick. And I think he was worried about that also. So he just put it away. It is somewhere. Someone has that stick. I forgot. Maybe it's a poor egg. Probably it's a poor egg. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Still on the altar. Yes, Peter?
Well, first of all, I wanted to support Jane's comment about propping up the mudra, if I heard it right, but that helps a lot for me, at least, using various paraphernalia that's around here that you bring with you, especially in a long sesshin, that takes a lot of tension off my neck and shoulders. I also wanted to respond to Samya's question about cheating. In my early years, Zazen practice, I didn't cheat. I thought I wasn't allowed, or whatever it is, I thought I was going to get to what's going to be postponed by cheating. But particularly with me, cheating ended up with two knee operations, and four meniscus, minor operations relative to arthroscopic surgery, but it definitely was pointed to the not cheating attitude. So I don't recommend that. I mean, there are times when you learn your pain and you learn when cheating is necessary to to respect your body. And one way to not have to cheat much, of course, is beginning yoga practice simultaneously with sitting practice, which I was moving behind that order of things, but nothing against cheating.
Yeah. It's not called
and
cheating.
And as a go on, I announce that we're at the beginning of kinging.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Let's not call it cheating.
Yeah.
Let's call it flexible.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah.
You're bringing a little flexibility in. A soft, subtle kind of flexibility.
I'm thinking, yeah, I don't understand all this. I don't know where I'm supposed to go somewhere or achieve anything. But whenever I come to Dikoji, I see the precepts about positive waving. I just love it. In the bathroom now, it's I'm not very intellectual about this practice, the four things.
Bodhisattva vows.
The gods have for the
best. Yeah.
Well, the last one is have fun. Everybody have fun. if your body's bothering you, there's a problem. That's, change something. Listen to yourselves. Pay attention to what's going on in yourself, in the world.
But sometimes there are places where you have to just endure. Not to the point that Peter was talking about at all, but if you're too loose, you miss. So it's very subtle. It needs paying a lot of attention.
And spend so much time adjusting our body and forget to see what our thoughts are showing us.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember some woman who was having a terrible time. And she came to Dokusan and said she didn't know what to do. And I asked if there was anything in her life that was bothering her. And she burst into tears and said, well, her cat had just died. And it was the whole thing. It was right there. And she had not noticed that she was carrying this grief. So it's all connected. There's no difference between the body and the mind. It's all self-service all the way through.
And it's, and we're supposed to be carrying on, but so often what you're feeling doesn't have thoughts rising, so you know that's when it's really super have to pay attention. It's really can be so difficult, you know.
Yeah,
that's really rough to ride that one out because there's no markers. You know, you're just trusting that it's going to take you somewhere.
Exactly, trust is the word, and we're all here with that trust. It's the most important mind to bring, just to give our faith to this practice. So thank you all.
Are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to defend them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.